ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Online, it feels like the answer is always yes. Yes to cookies. Yes to tracking. Yes to data sharing. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I find out what happens when you finally say no. Opt Out, a special series on Download This Show, ABC Radio National. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
You know, knowledge lies at the heart of a healthy democracy. And its many custodians include libraries, think of them, universities, cultural institutions, and a free and independent media. But in America right now, these are all being undermined in some way, intimidated, threatened, defunded by the Trump administration. And today on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National Summer, where we bring you your and our favourite episodes of the past year, is the US entering a period of dark enlightenment? On the eve of last year's US election, we brought you a really powerful speech by the renowned historian, author and cultural critic, Sarah Churchwell. Sarah opens up the pages of classical American literature and uses it to make sense of the national psyche. And her books include Careless People, Murder, Mayhem and the Invention of the Great Gatsby, and The Wrath to Come, Gone with the Wind and the Lies America Tells. You get the picture. Many of you found her so gripping, and today on Big Ideas, she's back to respond now to the nation under Trump. She's Professor of American Literature and Chair of Public Understanding of the Humanities at the University of London, and she joins you from Gadigal Country at the University of Technology Sydney's Vice-Chancellor's Democracy Forum.
Thank you, Vice-Chancellor, and thank you all for coming. I begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which we gather, and paying my respects to their elders, past and present. As a visitor who grew up in the United States, I also acknowledge the indigenous peoples of my own country, whose histories, cultures, and resistance shape the story of America. Any honest reckoning with national myths, which is what I hope to do here tonight with you, at least partially, must begin with the land, with the histories that have too often been silenced, and with a sovereignty that was never ceded. Your national act of acknowledgement, this growing cultural act of acknowledgement, your welcome to the country, has made me reflect more deeply on what connects our nations, not just in principle, but in practice. What it means to welcome people to your country and to recognize how much our countries share. There is a deep, in my experience anyway, often under-acknowledged kinship among the settler democracies shaped by British colonialism. Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and the United States, built on indigenous dispossession and myths of frontier democracy. While, of course, all of our histories diverge in very important ways, the structural parallels also run deep. Common foundations, common tensions, and some common myths. So today I'm here to talk about what's happening in America right now and where I see it coming from. But I think we all see the parallels and warnings around the world. Many of us, I'm happy to say, have been heartened by the results of your recent election. So thank you for holding the line. I say this on behalf of many people around the world who have said, oh, I'm so glad you're in Australia. Please thank them for us. So I am extending everyone's thanks. And also thank you all for your interest in what I have to say about America and about the United States, which are not the same thing. The United States is a legal and geopolitical entity. America is a cultural idea. They're entangled, but they're not the same. And recognizing their difference is essential to understanding how our cultural narratives are shaping political reality. Recognizing the difference between America and the United States is essential to understanding how our cultural narratives today are shaping political reality. Politics are downstream of culture, which means they are also downstream of prevailing cultural myths. Myths are not just stories. They are frameworks for distributing and justifying power. They shape memory and political imagination. They help determine who belongs, who dominates, who is silenced. They don't merely reflect the world, they help build it, and they work to justify its structures. Myths aren't just cultural ideas. They often serve as political scripts. They offer emotional clarity where history demands complexity, flattening contradictions and turning history into spectacle, a curated story in which dissent is delegitimized and uncomfortable realities are erased. It's worth remembering, and I'm going to come back to this again throughout this talk, cultivate and culture share the same root. What we choose to cultivate shapes the culture we end up living in. Now, I've been making some abstract claims there in the beginning, so let me begin with a brief and hopefully familiar example to many. And this little introduction here, I'm just going to basically try to summarize the argument of my most recent book, which, as you've heard, is called The Wrath to Come, Gone with the Wind and the Lies America Tells. It's a long book. It was supposed to be a short book. It became a long book. I'm now going to try to make a very, very short summary of it, and we'll see how I do. Most of you will know, I think, whether you know the book or the film, that Gone with the Wind is a famous melodrama set during the American Civil War and its aftermath from the 1860s to the 1880s. That's when the action of the story takes place. It was published in 1936 during the rise of European fascism, and its film version was completed just days before the start of the Second World War. It may seem easy to dismiss Gone with the Wind, and lots of people do, as a romance in hoop skirts. But this story, my contention is that this story, well, actually, this is a fact, this story is one of the most influential pieces of white supremacist propaganda in American popular history, without any question. The story insists that the American Civil War was a tragedy not because it was fought to preserve racialized slavery, but because it disrupted a supposedly noble and innocent way of life. It sanctifies the reimposition of white dominance as a moral redemption and a vindication. If you've ever read the novel, just look at it again. Gone with the Wind promotes straight-up blood and soil nationalism. Scarlett O'Hara's devotion to Tara, her plantation, is profoundly mythologized, and her return to Tara is the story's true happy ending. It's often spoken of as a tragedy, but it's not a tragedy. She gets to keep her plantation, and that's what she wants the most. The land becomes a site of racial destiny, in which white identity is fused with inherited property. The race and the nation are bound together in this story by blood and territory, and that should sound familiar to anyone who has learned anything about European fascism. There is also, and not incidentally, a Gotterdammerung narrative running through the story, the myth of tragic decline, of a civilization undone. The word Gotterdammerung, as I'm sure you all know, means twilight of the gods, and that's the word that Ashley Wilkes uses in the novel to describe the end of their world of antebellum slavery in the South, a twilight of the gods, and that was also a term embraced by Nazi Germany. In the novel, Ashley, who is the object of Scarlett's adoration, is the head of the Atlanta branch of the Ku Klux Klan. It is depicted not as a terrorist organization, but as a moral necessity. Lynching is presented as a form of Southern honor. Killing an uppity, Mitchell's word, black man, is treated as a mark of residual virtue. Rhett Butler, the novel's hero, lynches more than one black man over the course of the novel. Pitted against Ashley's effete civilizational decline, Rhett is figured as the emblem of a brute cynicism, a social Darwinist ethos in which power justifies itself and racist violence is redemptive. Black people are described throughout the novel in infantilizing and animalistic terms. They're called apes, monkeys, baboons, gorillas, and worse, lots worse. Emancipation is portrayed as a disaster for the formerly enslaved, who were better off, we are explicitly told by the story, in bondage. This is a story that says that the enslaved were better off enslaved. Explicitly, in so many words. The narrative insists that only those freed people who reject emancipation deserve sympathy, making loyalty to their own subjugation the mark of moral worth. The story is also suffused with a fierce anti-Americanism, almost entirely overlooked by its audiences then and now. Its protagonists despise the U.S. government. They refuse loyalty oaths, and they revile the American flag. Scarlett burns with a deep resentment when she sees the American flag fly over her city of Atlanta. In sum, Gone with the Wind glorifies white supremacy through the use of myth-making, It embeds the idea that white power once disrupted must be restored, violently if necessary. That fantasy of racial grievance and noble victimhood didn't end in the 1860s or in the 1930s. It continues to animate white revanchism in American politics today. Gone with the Wind captures the origin myth of white grievance in America, the idea that white people are victimized by racial justice. Stories like this are how myth becomes power, not simply by reflecting what a society already believes, but by teaching it what to remember, what to forget, and offering it consoling fantasies to protect the ultimate myth of its own heroic innocence. Such stories do more than distort memory. They corrode the conditions that make democracy possible, seeding confusion, eroding shared truth, and weakening the institutions that sustain public reason. This isn't merely a fiction, it's a myth. The difference is not in form, but in function. Fiction may entertain, provoke, or critique, but it presents itself as imaginary. But the kind of myth-making Gone with the Wind performs is claiming the authority of historical truth, presenting ideology as memory and power as destiny. So I want to turn now from myth and towards some history. Here is a little bit of historical background behind the myth-making of Gone with the Wind. Following the emancipation of enslaved people, the end of the Civil War in 1865, and Lincoln's assassination just days later, white supremacist forces immediately began what the great African-American historian W.E.B. Du Bois called the counter-revolution of property, seeking to restore the power and racial hierarchies they had just lost because they didn't win the war. What they called the redemption movement sought to restore white rule through terrorism, lynching, and political violence. January 6, 2021 was not the first time armed insurrectionists tried to overturn the outcome of an election they didn't like in the United States. There is an occluded history of American insurrections since the Civil War, some of them successful. During Reconstruction, the period that immediately followed the Civil War, armed white supremacists staged coups across the South, from Louisiana to North Carolina. They murdered black citizens and overthrew multiracial local governments, often with impunity. In 1898, a white mob in North Carolina deposed a multiracial Democratic elected city government, killed at least 60 black citizens, and installed white supremacists. It remains the only successful coup d'etat in US history. No one was punished, no one was removed, and we rarely talk about it. Groups like the Klan emerged in 1866-67 as part of this wave of insurrections against multiracial democracy. The Klan and other groups like it were the extra-legal enforcement arm of this counter-revolution. They were joined by groups that are much less famous than the Klan, forgotten now, the Red Shirts, the White League, the Knights of the White Camellia. Together, they built what Du Bois called a racial dictatorship, enforcing a caste system that became known as Jim Crow. Jim Crow, which was codified from the 1880s through the 1960s, imposed racial segregation and white supremacy through law and terror. And when the first Klan was eradicated by federal forces in the 1870s, the system just adapted. A new Klan emerged in 1915 after the lynching of Jewish factory manager Leo Frank in Atlanta. This second Klan fused white supremacy with anti-Catholicism and anti-Semitism, becoming a mass movement with millions of members across the 1920s, not just in the South. The Klan's largest base in the 1920s was in Indiana, in the Midwest. I grew up in Illinois, the state next door. It thrived in Minnesota, in New York, on Long Island, in California. There were lynchings in Oakland, California. There were lynchings in Duluth, Minnesota, in the 1920s. It wasn't an aberration. It was America. Much of the Klan's worldview reflected mainstream culture. Madison Grant's The Passing of the Great Race was a huge bestseller in 1915 and became foundational for American eugenics. In that book, Grant coins the phrase, the master race. That's where Hitler got it from. Hitler called that book his Bible. Grant helped shape the 1924 Immigration Act that restricted immigration to the United States through really the 1960s, and he did it to preserve the dominance of a master race by restricting non-Anglo immigrants. Admiration for authoritarianism during this time was open in the US. The Saturday Evening Post, the most popular magazine in America, praised Mussolini for his masterfulness. The director of the American Legion offered Mussolini honorary membership. In 1923, Hitler called Henry Ford the leader of the growing fascist movement in America. Ford's The International Jew was translated into German and praised by Goebbels. As the Klan declined in the late 1920s, its adherents simply formed other groups and rebranded. Many of them self-identified at that point as fascists. By the early 1930s, the U.S. had dozens of self-identified fascist groups. The black shirts, the silver shirts, the white shirts, the gray shirts, the khaki shirts. There were so many, the press dubbed them the Haberdashery Brigade. They said we were competing, and because it was America, we always had to have more. So they were like, we have more than Europe has. They weren't isolated. They formed an ecosystem of homegrown fascism, rooted in white supremacy and Christian nationalism, and I will be coming back to that point. Like I said, what you cultivate becomes your culture. Black intellectuals at the time saw this clearly, and they wrote about it at length. Du Bois, Langston Hughes, many other people, Kelly Miller, all argued that Nazi racial laws were modeled on Jim Crow. They could see it really clearly. Kelly Miller called the parallels striking. A writer called George Schuyler called the Nazis the German Ku Klux Klan. White fascists agreed. George Dethridge, who revived the Knights of the White Camellia in the 1930s, so the Klan was not the only Reconstruction-era white supremacist group to be revived by fascists in the 1930s. The Knights of the White Camellia was revived by a man named George Dethridge, who told the Saturday Evening Post in 1939 that it was thanks to the Klan that America started toward fascism long before Germany. Nazi policy toward the Jews, he said, is only a copy of the Klan's program for the Negroes. Even the Nazi salute, he claimed, was, quote, a straight steal from the Klan. And he wanted credit for it. It went beyond rhetoric. In 1933, the khaki shirts leader proposed an armed march on Washington to emulate Mussolini's march on Rome, abolish Congress, and install an authoritarian regime he called manocracy, rule by strong men. Only a police raid stopped him. Manocracy, as a fantasy of male domination, has returned in the digital age. Today's manosphere, online influencers, forums, podcasts, echoes the same language. Domination without accountability, wealth without responsibility, rule without consent. We don't need to compare Trumpism to European interwar fascism to understand what it is. If we compare it to American interwar fascism, like to like, the match is perfect. The alarms go ding, ding, ding. We've been told fascism was foreign and quarantined in Europe. But the truth is, it happened in America. It happened in most places. It just didn't take power everywhere. It was homegrown, and it never left. What followed in the 1930s and 40s became known later as the Brown Scare, when the Roosevelt administration targeted far-right seditionists and Nazi collaborators operating inside the United States. There was even a big case, the 1944 Great Sedition Trial, but the case descended into chaos and collapsed in a mistrial. The political will to pursue a second trial disappeared, and with it, so did much of the memory of what it had revealed. What might have been a public reckoning with American fascism instead became its burial. The dominant narrative shifted. Not that fascism had taken root, but that the danger had been exaggerated, an hysterical overreaction. American fascism was pushed underground. Not eradicated, just unacknowledged. And for the next 50 years, it cultivated its roots. It began to flourish as an underground culture. This widespread forgetting of American fascism coincided with a decision to cultivate fear of a different threat. The Red Scare of the 1950s redirected public paranoia from the far right to the progressive left, which was accused of being far left, but often wasn't by any rational reckoning. Some of it was, of course, but not all of it. McCarthyism attacked civil rights activists, labor organizers, feminists, critics of capitalism, branding any left-wing dissent as treason. This inversion opened space for a new form of right-wing extremism to regroup, not as violent street movements, but as institutional ideology. In the late 1950s, a group called the John Birch Society was founded, by far the most organized and influential far-right group of its era. It denounced FDR's New Deal as socialist and accused President Eisenhower, a Republican general, of being a communist agent. The Birchers sought to block U.S.-Soviet cooperation, withdraw from the United Nations, purge communists from the federal government, impeach Chief Justice Earl Warren. It opposed civil rights, feminism, public education, and internationalism, promoting instead a radically privatized, racially exclusive, Christianized vision of America that was rooted in conspiracy, paranoia, and nationalism. The Birchers were treated as fringe by many in their own time, but their ideas didn't disappear. They were smuggled into the mainstream through coded language, grassroots organizing, and generational transmission. And they were routinely associated with an old slogan with deep roots, America First, used by the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s, by American Nazi sympathizers in the 1930s, and associated with the Birch Society by the early 1960s as a rallying cry against civil rights and internationalism. The Birchers were also, not incidentally, publicly defended in 1961 by a certain George Dethridge, still around and kicking 20 years later, and publishing on an America First letterhead. He'd rebranded again. In the decades that followed, the Birchers' legacy flowed into Republican politics. Nixon's Southern strategy adopted the language of states' rights and law and order to court white voters who had previously supported segregation. Reagan launched his 1980 campaign with a states' rights speech in Mississippi, near where three civil rights workers were murdered in 1964. Many historians have interpreted, well, then and now, have interpreted this as what we call a dog whistle. He also courted the Christian right, elevating leaders who preached nationalist, anti-secular doctrine. In the 1990s, Pat Buchanan, a former Nixon and Reagan advisor, launched his own presidential campaigns under the banner of America First. Some of us are old enough to remember Buchanan's campaign. He denounced immigration, feminism, multiculturalism, and global trade, railing against a new world order and championing a culturally and racially homogeneous nation. He called for an American restoration. And a certain Donald Trump briefly joined Buchanan's Reform Party in 1999, saying that he was thinking about challenging Buchanan for the leadership of his own party, exploring a presidential run before returning to the Republican fold. That restorationist vision that Buchanan espoused has become the central ideology of today's Republican right. The language is louder and more explicit, but the message has not really changed, and neither has the slogan. It has been America First since the 1920s, really since the 1850s, but I'm not going to go back that far. I can get into that in Q&A if you want. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky, who some of you may know of, son of longtime Congressman Ron Paul. Ron Paul frequently appeared at John Birch Society events and echoed their conspiratorial rhetoric. His son Rand Paul has not formally aligned himself with the Birchers, but he has inherited many of their core ideas. From anti-globalist paranoia to attacks on federal institutions, he positions himself as a contemporary heir to the Bircher legacy within mainstream politics. Other figures, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, Paul Gosar, echo Bircher talking points almost verbatim, railing against globalists, denouncing federal agencies as deep state actors, and portraying their political opponents not as fellow citizens, but as existential threats to the republic. The American right has spent generations convincing the public that fascism is a European relic, that communism is always one election away, and that authoritarianism is only a threat when it comes from the left. The result has been a long-sustained realignment of the American political imagination. The John Birch Society was, not incidentally, endorsed reciprocally by a number of other groups, including, and I want to see if you can spot the pattern here, the Christian Crusade, the Christian Nationalist Crusade, the Christian Anti-Communism Crusade, the Church League of America, the Council of Christian Churches, American Council of Christian Laymen, and the Christian Freedom Foundation. I think you all did spot the pattern. Christian nationalism has long offered a spiritual logic for American authoritarianism. It collapses the distinction between church and state, between political disagreement and moral deviance. It frames pluralism as sin and casts political opponents as enemies of God. The current Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, espouses Seven Mountains Dominionism, a theological doctrine calling for Christian control over all sectors of public life, education, media, government, law, and culture. Like the Birchers before him, Johnson insists that secular democracy isn't neutral, but evil, satanic. This is no longer fringe ideology. It sits at the center of American political power. Mike Johnson is third in line to the presidency after J.D. Vance. This theology is no longer a question of people's private convictions. It provides a public language of righteousness to movements that seek domination, telling believers that compromise is betrayal and power must be held in the name of divine justice. American nationalism has long functioned like a religion, treating the Constitution as a sacred text, the flag as a holy symbol, and the founders as saints, which they very much were not. Over time, a strain of white evangelicalism fused with this national myth and with Republican politics, giving rise to what many now call Christo-fascism. This worldview sees history as a prophetic countdown to apocalypse, scripture as infallible, and salvation as exclusive to Christianity. It forms a closed system where political power is cast as spiritual virtue and dominance as divine mandate. This helps explain how Protestant millenarians like Mike Johnson and Catholic hardliners like Justice Samuel Alito find common cause, because they share a belief in a divinely ordained American exceptionalism that they think is under attack and a mission to restore it by any means available. And they will do it by any means available. While Christian nationalism provided the theological justification for authoritarianism, a different myth began to serve as its cultural alibi, the American dream. This too carries a buried history. It's a lot more familiar as a phrase, obviously, the American dream, but I'm going to posit that you may not be familiar with the history I'm about to summarize. This history reveals how power can cloak itself in aspiration, and how political myth can be repurposed to serve the very forces it once resisted. Because the phrase American dream began to take shape around the turn of the 20th century, not as a slogan for wealth or upward social mobility, or as a story about immigrants, but as a warning about national ideals under threat. I have found no trace of it in the American conversation before the 1890s. But by 1900, it surfaces in public discourse as a moral concern, not a celebration. One early usage comes from the New York Post in 1900, which warned that the gravest danger to the American Republic would come not from the poor, but from, and I quote, discontented multimillionaires. 1900. Every republic that has ever fallen, it wrote, was overthrown by rich men. If such men could deride the Constitution unrebuked by the executive or by public opinion, it would mark, in the paper's phrase, the end of the American dream. The origins of the American dream as an idiom were in direct opposition to personal enrichment. They were a defense of democratic equality against the consolidation of oligarchic power. That warning about impunity for the rich, about public apathy in the face of it, and executive complicity, I heard you all murmur, so I don't have to tell you how that reads like a chilling premonition of what we see today, in which a billionaire is openly mocking constitutional limits and facing little meaningful rebuke from the institutions that are meant to constrain him. And in 1900, they said, this will be the death of the American dream, because the dream did not mean personal enrichment. It meant democracy. From the start, the phrase American dream was rooted in anxiety about corruption and inequality. It was invoked to defend collective justice, not private gain. It warned that democracy would falter if the pursuit of wealth overwhelmed the pursuit of fairness. In these early years, the American dream expressed unease about declining civic virtue. It critiqued acquisitiveness rather than endorsing it. The term American dream entered the national consciousness in 1931 with a book called The Epic of America by James Truslow Adams, written during the Great Depression. Adams asked whether, and I quote again, the American dream of a better, richer, and happier life for all our citizens of every rank would survive economic collapse. But by richer, Adams meant not just material wealth. He was very explicit. He meant richness in spirit, in purpose, in public life. As the phrase gained traction in the 1930s, some began to redefine it, not as civic aspiration, but as personal advancement. After the Second World War, this transformation accelerated. And during the Cold War, the American dream was rebranded to the familiar idea that we all know so well today. Not as a moral ideal, but as an ideological weapon. That is when it became a symbol of capitalist triumph. The car, the fridge, the suburban house, the rising paycheck. It was marketed abroad as proof of our moral superiority and at home as a shield against dissent. That version of the dream was racialized from the outset. Federal policies ensured post-war prosperity flowed unequally. White families built wealth through state-backed mortgages while black families were shut out. Yet the rhetoric insisted the dream was universal. By the 1950s, the phrase had come to signify upward mobility through personal effort. Success was proof of virtue. Failure signaled personal defeat. Inequality was no longer structural. It had become a moral verdict on your character. And today, a phrase once used to challenge oligarchy now justifies it. A dream rooted in equity has been hollowed out and rebranded as lifestyle. Yet, Adam's vision has not been erased because historians and readers fight to keep it alive. It remains imperfect, but available as an ethic of public knowledge, collective striving, and civic responsibility. Reclaiming that idea is not nostalgia, it's democratic work. Trumpism, I said I would get here, weaponizes all of these traditions. The mythology of racial innocence, suspicion of democratic institutions, contempt for pluralism, hostility to public reasoning, the uncivil religion of authoritarian Christian nationalism, and this inverted American dream. Trump, of course, famously invoked the American dream in his 2017 inauguration, declaring it dead. But he meant the dream as he defined it: crude, exclusionary, transactional, just like him. It was a promise of restoration, not reform, an America that belonged to him and those like him. His version was always also racialized, gendered, and nostalgic for a world of unchallenged dominance. His rhetoric was backed by policy. Trump revived America First as the economic counterpart to his mythic dream, tying it to punitive tariffs and protectionist bluster. In fact, the phrase America First had initially emerged on the national stage in the context of tariffs, first gaining traction in the 1880s as a slogan for economic nationalism, and that too was revived. The machinery was in place. The legacy of the Birchers, the memory holding of American fascism, the fusion of market fundamentalism and moral panic, the hollowed out American dream, the evangelical eschatology. Trump activated the circuit, linking these elements with populist demagoguery that made grievance feel like justice. He told his followers that something had been stolen from them, that greatness had been lost, enemies were within, and only he could restore the nation. I'm going to quote now. I realize that looking at this, I should have made clearer that this is a quotation. Otherwise, it could sound like me. This is a quote. I disagree with it. Universities do not pursue knowledge and truth. They pursue deceit and lies, declared J.D. Vance in 2021. This from a man who rose from poverty to the vice presidency entirely thanks to an elite education at Yale. Speaking at a national conservatism conference, Vance urged his audience to, quote, honestly and aggressively attack the universities in this country. The professors, he said, are the enemy. Well, speaking on behalf of professors everywhere, it's true most of us don't think much of J.D. Vance. I, for one, am certainly the enemy of what he represents. Vance and his billionaire patron, Peter, I never know if it's Thiel or Teal, some of you will know, have both voiced support for the so-called Dark Enlightenment, a reactionary movement rooted in contempt for democracy and open society. One of its leading theorists, Curtis Yarvin, said in 2021, the same year that Vance made those remarks, he said that if a hypothetical authoritarian were to seize power in the United States, quote, you can't continue to have a Harvard or a New York Times pass since perhaps the start of April, assuming an inauguration in January. He added, the idea that you're going to be a Caesar and take power and operate with someone else's department of reality and operation is just manifestly absurd. You can't have a Harvard, he insisted. And you might have noticed that they attacked Harvard first. This isn't a conspiracy theory. It's a declared political strategy. They said it out loud, and they're executing it. The Dark Enlightenment, which is a term coined by British philosopher Nick Land and promoted in the US by Yarvin, says outright what earlier reactionary movements only hinted. Democracy isn't just flawed, it's a mistake. Not merely inefficient, but illegitimate. In its place, they propose rule by the few, CEOs, technocrats, strongmen. Their ideal society is corporate. In this, they echo Mussolini's idea of corporatism, society not as a democracy, but as a managed enterprise. Both models fuse state and economy, reject popular sovereignty, and sell authoritarianism as optimization. The Dark Enlightenment doesn't come draped in flags or uniforms. It comes dressed in Silicon Valley sneakers and baseball hats. Its prophets are venture capitalists. Its preachers are bloggers. Its gospel is acceleration. Its God is the market. Thiel has declared, "I no longer believe that freedom and democracy are compatible." His political donations reflect that belief, supporting candidates who don't want to reform institutions, but to dismantle them. Vance, bankrolled by Thiel, has echoed this agenda, portraying universities as decadent, the press as treasonous, and the rule of law as optional when he finds it inconvenient. Their efforts to delegitimize and defund the university system are not because it's irrelevant, but because it remains one of the last institutions that fosters public reasoning and challenges their dominance. Because what the Dark Enlightenment offers isn't a coherent theory of government or anything like a serious reading of history. It's a mythology, a new myth for an old kind of power, cosplaying as innovation in the language of techno-utopia. It dreams of neo-feudalism, of a return to a pre-democratic world, a fantasy of a ruling class of overlords managing the world from above, not by divine right, but by algorithmic superiority. However, it also conveniently assumes that its new aristocracy will continue to enjoy the protection of contracts, banking systems, and the same rule of law they denounce as tyrannical when it inconveniences them, while relying on those very systems for every financial transaction they make. Unless Musk and Thiel truly plan to settle their future disputes mano a mano on a mountaintop, they will still require courts, treaties, and institutions to enforce their property claims. They rely on what they seek to destroy. But coherence isn't the point. In a media ecosystem saturated with myth and conspiracy, spectacle is what matters. The goal is to flood the public imagination with the sense that democracy has failed and that brutal, unequal order is the only alternative. Back in 1931, James Truslow Adams ended the book that popularized the phrase "the American dream" with an image of what he said for his reader was the perfect symbol of the American dream in action. It was not an immigrant who made good, a self-made man, or the iconic house with a white picket fence. It was, Adams said, a room the nation had gifted to itself, namely, the public reading room at the Library of Congress, created so that every American, Adams wrote, quote, old and young, rich and poor, black and white, the executive and the laborer, the general and the private, the noted scholar and the schoolboy, could sit together, he said, reading at their own library, provided by their own democracy. It has always seemed to me, Adams wrote, to be a perfect working out in a concrete example of the American dream, provided by the shared resources of the people themselves, sustained by a public intelligent enough to use them, in his phrase, and guided by citizens who, as part of the democracy they serve, devote themselves to the common good. It's an image of peaceful, collective, enlightened self-improvement. That, according to the man who coined the phrase, is the American dream, grounded in education, shared knowledge, historical inquiry, and a commitment to the public good. Adams was writing during the Great Depression. He was not naive about the United States in 1931. He saw the library not just as a cultural institution, but as a political one, an embodiment of democracy's ability to sustain itself. He ended with a warning that now reads as uncannily prophetic. No ruling class, he said, has ever willingly abdicated. Democracy can never be saved and would not be worth saving unless it can save itself. The Library of Congress, he added, however, has come straight from the heart of democracy as it has been taken to it, and here I use it as a symbol of what democracy can accomplish on its own behalf. The Library of Congress for Adams was the American dream made concrete. Knowledge as a public right, citizenship as a shared project. Democracy, if it meant anything, meant this. 6 days ago, Donald Trump abruptly fired the head of the Library of Congress. This position, as its name indicates, is overseen by Congress, not by the president. It's not clear that he had the right to fire her, but he did. 2 days later, Trump also fired the Register of Copyrights and Director of the U.S. Copyright Office, who sits within the Library of Congress. As legislators pointed out, this decision coincidentally followed almost immediately upon her refusal to rubber stamp Elon Musk's demand that copyright be overridden in his favor to accelerate AI data scraping. She refused, and Trump fired her 4 days ago. He's not throwing a tantrum. This isn't random. It's part of a coordinated attack on public knowledge and the institutions that safeguard it. They are targeting the repositories of research and shared memory, not because they are decadent or weak or malfeasant, but precisely because they are powerful. The Library of Congress isn't a symbol. It's a battleground for a fight over public intelligence, shared learning, collective self-rule, democracy, like Adams told us. That is what they are trying to dismantle, and they know where it is built, and they know where it is safeguarded. The name Dark Enlightenment tells us exactly what's at stake. The Enlightenment and democracy co-developed across the 17th and 18th centuries. They have historically coexisted. They may well be codependent, perhaps even coterminous, such that if one ends, the other may fall with it. I don't claim to know for sure, but I wouldn't be surprised. The Dark Enlightenment isn't just a fringe ideology. It's another counter-revolution, an open attack on the intellectual and institutional foundations of modern public life. It opposes not only democracy, but the very idea that society should be governed by reason, by tested knowledge, by shared responsibility or universal rights. It sees equality not as a democratic goal, but as a design flaw. To grasp what's being dismantled, we have to remember what the Enlightenment built. It produced not only new ideas, but the institutions that supported them: public education, the modern university, public libraries, and the democratic state. Together, these gave rise to a literate citizenry, an informed electorate, and the emergence of a broad middle class. They created the frameworks for accountability, shared knowledge, collective judgment. The Dark Enlightenment aims to hollow out the systems that make resistance possible. It wants to replace inquiry with obedience, evidence with ideology, and public education with private control. It fears universities and libraries precisely because they house public memory. They are custodians of the archive. They ask questions. They resist myth. The humanities are being dismantled not because they failed, but because they work. Which is why Yarvin said their political reality can't coexist with a Harvard and a New York Times at its center. He's right. None of this is to deny that Enlightenment humanism was partial, exclusionary, failed in many ways, and compromised. Its so-called universal subject excluded most of humanity, including me. Its institutions colluded in empire and capital. But the answer to those failures surely isn't retreat and collapse. It's expansion of rights, of reason, of justice, not to abandon the project, to radicalize it. The Dark Enlightenment wants to remake the world by narrowing who counts, silencing dissent, and consolidating power in the hands of the few. The humanities and the Enlightenment project that we sustain fight to remake it too, but by widening the circle, questioning inherited authority, and insisting that knowledge belongs to the many. We do not defend the humanities because they are inherently virtuous. They are not. We defend them because they remain the best tools we have for public reasoning, for truth without obedience, for memory without myth, for critique without permission. Their value lies not in moral purity, but in their insistence that truth and imagination are public acts. What we defend isn't a perfect inheritance. It's the fragile, unfinished work of public truth against private myth. If democracy has a future, it will come from the practices authoritarianism resists the hardest for a reason. Remembering clearly, reasoning publicly, and refusing to let lies settle into history. That is the work of the humanities, and that is why our work matters, because truth is fragile, complicated, plural, and contested, just like the humanity for whom we are named. Messy, divided, unfinished, and yet still capable of imagining something better. In that recognition lies the struggle. It is a struggle that will never end, and it's a struggle that will always be worth the fight. I found out today that a professional mentor and friend of mine died unexpectedly on Monday. It was in no small part thanks to his unwavering support that I was appointed the UK's first chair in public understanding of the humanities, and I want to dedicate this talk to him, a fine scholar and a kind man who always fought the good fight. Thank you.
Quite a speech, isn't it? By Sarah Churchwell there. She is Professor of American Literature and Chair of Public Understanding of the Humanities at the University of London. And she's with you on Big Ideas on ABC Radio National with me, Natasha Mitchell, speaking at the University of Technology, Sydney. Joined now in conversation with award-winning Australian author and UTS ambassador Anna Funder and Emeritus Professor Roy Green.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It's a remarkable talk that you've given, and I think we've all learned so much. It's placed contemporary developments in a very clear and quite ominous historical context. So many questions come to mind, but this one I'm sure is on many people's minds. We're seeing many examples of populist and fascist movements in history, in no small part in the US or in America, but this one coincides also with the rise of the billionaire class that you referred to. And we're not talking about the 1%, we're talking about the 0.1% or the 0.01%. And these are people whose wealth has been based on the development of technology, often driven by universities, and who are now in charge of something which is increasingly described as surveillance capitalism. But surely we must ask ourselves, the interests of those in populist movements cannot be the same as the billionaire class. I think it was Bertrand Russell who said, first they fascinate the fools and then they muzzle the intelligentsia, his definition of fascism. And the question really here is, if the billionaire class, as you've described them, see democracy as incompatible with capitalism, at what point do those supporting these populist movements, and apparently in the last election a majority of those who voted, at what point does it come in such contradiction with the interests of those who are seeking power that somehow the scales fall from their eyes, or somehow the need to break free from that control becomes apparent?
I wish I knew the answer to that question, because if I did, I would try to accelerate that that eventuality. Look, I think that history offers many examples where the scales don't fall from people's eyes. And we've all seen it. The degree to which what I will describe as cognitive dissonance and willful blindness, the degree to which people who voted for Trump now, you know, many times, they're at a point now where their own sense of themselves will not permit them to admit that he is engaged in an assault on democracy. It isn't consistent with their self-image. So they can't say that they were wrong about this. So there's this elaborate face-saving that has to go on. And so these very contorted arguments start to, these frankly ludicrous arguments that those of us on the outside of this system find laughable. But they have these distorted arguments that let them justify this in their heads. So my fear is that what's going to happen is that the eventuality you described will happen. Ultimately, they will realize that they've lost democratic power. They'll realize that they actually are subject to a surveillance capitalism. But they'll either tell themselves it's fine, or it will be too late. I mean, I am, many of you will know on social media the meme of the little dog drinking coffee surrounded by fire saying it's fine. We're seeing a lot of that right now. So do I think that eventually they will recognize that the billionaires don't want what they want. You know, you can only blame immigrants and libraries for so long, you know? And eventually they start to be like, wait a minute, you've got all the money and all the power here. But the question is, when does that happen? And under what conditions? And will it be too late for the democratic processes to rebuild themselves? And I simply don't know the answer to that question, which is why I think it's so important that we beat the drum and warn as much as we can to whoever is listening to try to do what we can.
Just to continue with this dark enlightenment idea, it's been called an acceleration of capitalism to a fascist point. At what point does the dark enlightenment in its activities against the universities and the Library of Congress and so on effectively usher in a dark age? Many people have been shocked at how flimsy the constitution and institutional mechanisms of democracy have appeared to be since January. So I guess I'm asking those two questions connected. What can protect us, or in America, Americans in particular, how do those institutions become strengthened again? And if not, are we headed towards a dark age?
So I would say a couple of things about it. First of all, I have the privilege of being friends with some medieval historians, and I made a flippant comment about the Dark Ages one time, and they got really annoyed. And they said, what an ignorant thing to say. And I was like, I try not to be ignorant, and I'm not a medievalist. But anyway, they said, no, it's the Dark Ages because there's so little evidence, not because they were benighted, but because there's so little evidence. And that's where the phrase came from, which I hadn't known. But I think it's really pertinent to what you're saying and what I was arguing, right? Which is that, are we headed towards the Dark Ages? Yes, because they're trying to destroy the evidence. They're trying to destroy the archive. So it won't make us benighted, but it will mean that this repository of human knowledge is at risk, right? And, you know, exactly, Musk is trying to own it. He wants to own it all, right? And so this is why even little things like, you know, I am a huge fan of digitized libraries. They are amazing, and the access that they create is incredible. But we cannot get rid of the physical libraries, or they go in the cloud and somebody can pull a plug and they're gone. You know, Musk can just take them, right? So we have to, I think we have to think in those terms. Sorry, what was the second part of your question? I'm cheerful
it's
person,
about
but
institutions
when I talk
of democracy.
And the flimsy.
And how flimsy they have appeared to be, and how long it's going to take to reconstitute them and reconstitute faith in them. Yeah. You know, is it a work of generations?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, it is. And the faith is the word, right? I was talking about faith of one kind in my talk, but, you know, to me, the Constitution or any rule of law, any democratic system is only as strong as the people's faith in it. You know, no laws are upheld beyond the people's willingness to uphold them, right? That's what contract is. Both people agree to operate in what? In good faith. In my view, what we are facing as a global society, with all of the different places where we're facing these political challenges, I would not characterize it as a fight between left-wing politics and right-wing politics, really, although that's obviously part of it. I characterize it as a fight between good faith and bad faith. People who are operating, we don't have to be idealists, but who are operating in good faith, trying to, you know, to the best of our ability, to contribute to the greater good, insofar as we can.
And within the rules.
And within the rules. And then there are people who are operating in totally bad faith, in pure cynicism, with, you know, an entire power grab. We're never going to eradicate people's desire for power. We're primates, you know, that's not going anywhere. But what we can do, and this is, again, why your election was so heartening and the conversations that we've had, you know, I'm so interested in compulsory voting here and how it works. So, you know, and I think you guys have set up some really sensible systems for yourself, and I hope you will protect them because it's keeping the faith in the system and keeping the faith in and understanding that all of us have to put our shoulders to the collective wheel, that it doesn't survive without us. And that's why I said at the end that it's a struggle that will not end, and we have to go into it knowing that. But we have to know that it's a struggle worth fighting for, as I said.
I'd like you all to please join me in thanking Sarah.
A compelling distinction, isn't it? Good faith versus bad faith actors and the struggle for influence. Sarah Churchwell, Professor of American Literature and Chair of the Public Understanding of the Humanities at the University of London with hosts Anna Funder and Emeritus Professor Roy Green. Speaking at the University of Technology Sydney, thanks to them and to ABC sound engineer Tegan Nichols. And we'll link to Sarah's earlier appearance on Big Ideas in our show notes. Many of you loved that as well. It's well worth a listen. And I'm Natasha Mitchell. I'll catch you next time for more Big Ideas.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.